Hello, this is Jane from the Talking Information Center. Today we will be reading from the Wednesday, May 20th, 2026 edition of Reuters News. U.S. Supreme Court's uneven approach to election map rulings boosts Republicans, by Joseph Axe and John Krusel. The conservative-majority U.S. Supreme Court last December permitted Texas to move ahead with a new voting map beneficial to Republicans, as the justices faulted a lower court for issuing an order blocking it on the eve of an election. At the time, the Texas party primary elections were 4 months away, and the general election was 11 months off. The top U.S. judicial body's action in the case followed a legal concept known as the Purcell Principle. It established 2 decades ago that courts should strive to avoid changing voting rules too close to an election due to the risk of voter confusion. But the court, in separate decisions this month, cleared the way for Louisiana and Alabama to enact pro-Republican maps reconfiguring their U.S. House of Representative districts in those states, just days before in-person voting was set to begin in primaries and after thousands of mail-in ballots already had been cast. The court's seemingly inconsistent approach to the Purcell principle in those 3 cases resulted each time in a decision favorable to Republicans as President Donald Trump's party fights to retain control of Congress in November's midterm elections. The outcomes have prompted some legal experts to raise questions about the motivations of the conservative justices who hold a 6-3 majority on the court. I'll just say that the Purcell principle is not really a principle anymore, at least if we think principle means it's going to be consistently applied, University of Kentucky law professor Joshua Douglas said. Cynics would say this is politics all the way down, Douglas added, and there's evidence of that given that the court seems to be letting Republican-controlled states implement new maps when previously it had stopped lower court rulings against some of those maps. Restoring state legislative action. Not all experts see inconsistency in the court's actions. University of Notre Dame law professor Derek Mueller said the recent decisions shared a similar idea. Restoring state legislative action that had been blocked by a lower court. The cases, Mueller acknowledged, may inject uncertainty into elections due to their timing. But it's not because the court has changed the rules, Mueller said. It's because the court has stepped back and allowed the legislature to act. The legal principle arises from a 2006 case called Purcell versus Gonzalez, in which the Supreme Court lifted a judicial block on an Arizona voter identification law that a lower court had imposed 33 days before that year's midterm elections. But some legal experts said what began as a straightforward principle of judicial restraint in election-related cases has been turned on its head by the court's conservatives to aid Republicans. These experts said the court's recent actions have fueled the impression that it is driven primarily by political outcomes rather than the law, a perception that has rankled conservative Chief Justice John Roberts. In a process called redistricting, the boundaries of legislative districts across the United States are reconfigured to reflect population changes as measured by the national U.S. Census every 10 years. Redistricting traditionally has been carried out by state legislatures at the start of each new decade. In the unusual mid-decade redistricting fight now unfolding, Republicans have built a clear advantage, bolstered by the recent Supreme Court rulings. At Trump's urging, Republican-governed Texas redrew its electoral map last year in a bid to flip 5 Democratic-held U.S. House seats. Democratic-led California then reconfigured its map to target 5 Republican-held House seats. Multiple other states subsequently joined the fray. Democrats suffered a blow when the Supreme Court last month gutted a key provision of the 1965 Voting Rights Act, opening the door for Republican-led Southern states to dismantle Democratic-held majority Black and majority Latino districts ahead of the November elections. Black and Latino voters tend to support Democratic candidates. In its 6-3 ruling, with the conservative justices in the majority and the liberal justices dissenting, the Supreme Court struck down one of Louisiana's two majority black House districts. The decision landed on April 29th, 3 days before the scheduled start of early voting for Louisiana's May 16th primary election. This frenzy. UCLA law professor Richard Hazen, who coined the term Purcell principle 10 years ago, said the timing of the Louisiana ruling suggests that the Supreme Court is not overly worried about avoiding electoral disruption under this legal concept. The court issued the opinion as people were voting, knowing it was going to lead to this frenzy, Hazen said. If the court was actually concerned about upsetting election rules on the eve of an election, it would either have issued it earlier or later. Four Republican-led southern states, Louisiana, Tennessee, Alabama, and South Carolina, responded by rushing to dismantle several House districts with sizable black populations in time for the midterms. The Supreme Court's handling of Alabama's bid to reconfigure its voting maps may be the starkest example of its uneven approach. In January 2022, a federal court blocked Alabama from using a Republican-drawn map that the court decided unlawfully deprived black voters of an additional House district in which they comprise a majority or close to it, likely violating the Voting Rights Act. The next month, however, the Supreme Court ruled that this disputed voting map, advantageous to Republicans, needed to remain in place to avoid any disruption to the primary election looming more than 3 months later. Justice Brett Kavanaugh, writing a concurring opinion, joined by fellow conservative Justice Samuel Alito, said the election was too near to allow changing of maps. When an election is close at hand, Kavanaugh wrote, the rules of the road must be clear and settled. 4 years later, the court's conservatives seem to have paid little heed to those concerns. On May 11th, 8 days before Alabama's scheduled primaries, they cleared the way for the state to return to the same map, lifting a judicial order that had blocked its use. The Supreme Court provided no reasoning for its action. Republican Governor Kay Ivey immediately postponed the scheduled primaries for four House districts whose boundaries change under that map, effectively canceling any votes already cast in those contests. Law professor Justin Levitt of Loyola Marymount University said the conservative justices appear to have replaced the Purcell principle's broad command for judicial restraint with a new doctrine. Quote, when we like what's happening, we rule. End quote. I am not quick to accuse the court of indulging purely partisan leanings, but man, oh man, they're making it real difficult to try and figure out what they're doing, if it isn't that, said Levitt, who served as a White House advisor on democracy and voting rights under Democratic former President Joe Biden. Some of the murkiness surrounding the court's Purcell principle jurisprudence may stem from the fact that the related decisions have been issued under the court's emergency docket or shadow docket. In such cases, the court acts on emergency requests, often without explaining its legal reasoning. Part of the problem with the Purcell principle is that it's never been fully explained in a majority opinion, Hazen said. There's no hard and fast rule. Barney Frank, Wall Street reformer and first openly gay congressman, dies at 86. By Alastair Bell. Former U.S. Representative Barney Frank, a quick-witted Democrat who gave his name to a landmark financial reform bill after the economic crisis of 2007 through 2009, has died, his sister Ann Lewis said on Wednesday. He was 86. One of the best-known gay politicians of his time, Frank served for over 30 years in the U.S. House of Representatives as a member from Massachusetts and a liberal who gladly worked with Republicans. He's a guy you can sit down and deal with, Republican Representative Tom Cole from Oklahoma said in 2011 when Frank chaired the House Financial Services Committee. Along with then-Senator Chris Dodd, Frank spearheaded 2010 legislation that tightened banking regulations and consumer protections to avoid a repeat of the 2007 financial crash and subsequent Great Recession. Known as the Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act, the law led to the new rules on the previously unregulated off-exchange derivatives market and set up the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau to shield consumers from predatory and abusive practices. It was regarded as one of the main successes in Congress of Barack Obama's two-term presidency. Things would have sucked worse without me. As the financial crisis was unfolding and institutions such as Lehman Brothers Investment Bank were collapsing, Frank was at the heart of congressional efforts to save the U.S. banking industry and limit the damage to the wider economy. He shepherded the Treasury Department's $700 billion Troubled Asset Relief Program, TARP, bank bailout, through the House in 2008. The bailout stabilized the financial sector, with the government buying stock in eight major banks. By the time it ended in 2013, TARP had earned taxpayers a modest profit of $11 billion as the bank's share prices recovered. But it was criticized by some Democrats for not doing enough to help the crisis-bound housing market and for allowing bankers to receive large bonuses even as the market was crashing. Frank defended his role in the bailout despite its flaws. "I actually had a slogan which I was dissuaded from using in 2010, he told a C-SPAN event in 2014. It said, "Things would have sucked worse without me." A fast talker with a rumpled appearance, Frank was frequently voted both the funniest and the brainiest member of Congress by Capitol Hill staffers in the Washingtonian magazine. But his reputation as a banking regulation guru was called into question in March 2023 when the New York-based Signature Bank, of which Frank was a board member, collapsed along with Silicon Valley Bank and was seized by regulators. First openly gay congressman. The grandson of Jewish immigrants from Eastern Europe, Barnett Frank, was born on March 31, 1940, in Bayonne, New Jersey. A high school debating star, he graduated from Harvard University and started working for the Boston mayor's office in the late 1960s, before becoming an aide to a Democratic U.S. congressman from Massachusetts. In 1972, Frank ran for office himself, winning election as a Democrat to the Massachusetts State House, where the first bill he introduced was a groundbreaking attempt to ban anti-gay discrimination in housing and employment. The bill failed, but it was the start of Frank's long career as a defender of liberal causes. He won election to the U.S. House in 1980 and stayed there for 32 years. Frank's career was nearly sidelined by a 1989 scandal over his relationship with a male prostitute who became his housekeeper and driver and worked as an escort out of Frank's home. The House Ethics Committee investigated Frank, ruling that he did not know about the prostitution at his house, but recommending the full House reprimand him for using his congressional privileges to scrap dozens of the man's parking tickets. The scandal did little to affect voter support for Frank, who in 1987 had become the first congressman in U.S. history willingly to come out as gay. Frank became the first sitting member of Congress to marry a same-sex partner when he and Jim Reedy got married in 2012. Announcing his retirement from Congress in 2013, Frank quipped that it would be a relief because, "I don't even have to pretend to be nice to people I don't like." South Carolina lawmakers advance U.S. House map targeting powerful Democrat Clyburn by Joseph Axe. South Carolina's Republican-controlled House of Representatives approved a new congressional map early on Wednesday aimed at ousting longtime Democratic U.S. Representative Jim Clyburn in November's midterm elections. The map still needs approval from the state Senate, where Republicans hold a 34-12 advantage. The legislation would also postpone the state's primary elections for the U.S. House of Representatives from June 9th to August 18th to allow time for candidates to file again and run campaigns in the redrawn districts. The state legislature is meeting in a special session called by Republican Governor Henry McMaster, following pressure from President Donald Trump to redraw the state's map. Republicans already hold 6 of the state's 7 U.S. House seats. South Carolina is among several southern states that have rushed to take advantage of a U.S. Supreme Court decision in April that severely weakened protections for U.S. House of Representative districts that are largely comprised of Black or Latino voters who typically support Democrats. Louisiana, Alabama, and Tennessee have all moved to dismantle Democratic-held seats while postponing their U.S. primary elections to accommodate the new maps, in some cases invalidating thousands of absentee ballots that had already been returned by mail. The South Carolina legislation passed largely along party lines at 12:39 a.m. on Wednesday, following 2 marathon days of floor debate that each lasted more than 10 hours. Late on Monday, Republicans imposed new rules limiting the number of amendments that lawmakers could introduce after Democrats had offered hundreds in an effort to slow down the process. Democratic lawmakers decried the map as an effort to deny political power for Black voters. John King, a Black Democratic legislator, said on the chamber floor that the bill delivered a message to young Black boys and girls: "We don't want your voice in our democracy." Republicans denied that the redistricting effort was motivated by race. President Trump decisively won in South Carolina, not once, not twice, but 3 times, said Republican State Representative Luke Rankin, the lead sponsor of the map. "It's completely reasonable for the people that elected us here to expect that we send a full 7-0 Republican congressional delegation to Washington, D.C. Clyburn, 85, a Black Democrat and a party power broker, has represented South Carolina's 6th congressional district since 1993. Republicans are seeking to hold their slim majority in the U.S. House in November, when all 435 seats will be on the ballot. The court decision opened a new front in a national redistricting war that began last summer, when Trump pushed Texas Republicans to draw a new map targeting 5 Democratic incumbents. While Republicans have built a clear redistricting advantage, Democrats remain well-positioned to win a House majority, given Trump's sagging approval ratings and the unpopular Iran war. Trump IRS settlement forever bars audits into tax claims for Trump and his family. By Dan Rosenzweig Ziff. The U.S. Justice Department has forever barred the Internal Revenue Service from pursuing any audits into past tax claims for President Donald Trump, his relatives, and his companies, according to a 1-page document released Tuesday. The sweeping document, signed by Acting Attorney General Todd Blanche, said the U.S. government could not audit Trump's taxes return filed before Monday or any matters that were raised or could have been raised. The order expanded the settlement agreement Trump reached Monday with the IRS, in which he agreed to drop his $10 billion lawsuit over the leak of his tax returns. As part of the settlement, Justice Department created a nearly $1.8 billion fund to compensate victims of political weaponization. Blanche faced repeated questions Tuesday over that fund in his first congressional testimony since taking over as acting attorney general. Also by Dan Rosenzweig Ziff, U.S. Acting Attorney General Blanche won't rule out Trump weaponization payouts to January 6 rioters who assaulted police. U.S. Acting Attorney General Todd Blanche told lawmakers on Tuesday he could not commit to barring money from President Donald Trump's newly announced weaponization fund from going to people who assaulted police officers, including during the January 6, 2021 Capitol riot. Blanche, in his first congressional testimony since ascending to the top of the Justice Department after Pam Bondi's firing last month, also told Democratic senators that he could not commit to barring any of the nearly $1.8 billion from the settlement going to Trump campaign donors. The Justice Department on Monday created a nearly $1.8 billion fund to compensate victims of political weaponization to settle a lawsuit Trump had filed against his own government over the alleged mishandling of his tax records. The pool of money will be controlled by Trump allies who can give payments to those who claim to have suffered weaponization or lawfare by the U.S. government. A one-page document signed by Blanche and released Tuesday said the IRS is forever barred from pursuing any related investigation into Trump or his relatives, including into any tax returns filed before Monday. In questioning, Blanche denied that Trump set up the settlement fund. He said the five-member settlement commission, four of whom he'll directly appoint, will act independently. And he argued that former President Barack Obama's Justice Department had overseen a similar fund, though that one was signed off by a federal judge. The president did not direct me to do anything, he said, later adding that the fund's money could be given to members of any political party and is not limited to January 6 defendants. The standard for who will get the money, he said, is defined broadly by those who experienced weaponization. What we're talking about is nothing short of the sitting president of the United States looting from the Treasury for his own gain, said Senator Patty Murray, a Democrat from Washington State. Do you seriously think this arrangement is appropriate? Since Trump took office, the Justice Department has sought prosecutions against his enemies, dropped charges against his allies, and seen the core of the nation's top law enforcement department drop by 8,500 staff members. Blanche, whose appearance was scheduled to focus on the Justice Department 2027 budget, requested $41.2 billion in federal funding, a 13% increase over the previous year. The over two-hour hearing grew tense at times as Democrats and Blanche sparred over the fund and department's handling of the Jeffrey Epstein investigation. It also underscored near unanimous efforts by Republicans and Blanche to defend the president's agenda. Most Republican lawmakers heaped praise on Blanche for reversing what they saw as weak and vindictive law enforcement from the Biden administration and complimented Blanche for making Americans safer. Senator Susan Collins, a Republican from Maine, though, asked Blanche how and to whom the funds would be doled out. Blanche said the commission would act independently and issue quarterly reports to the Attorney General, details of which will be provided to lawmakers. He said anyone could apply and be considered. Collins said the money would come from a judgment fund used for other government settlements. Blanche also said that the fund money could be given to Republican lawmakers whose phone records were seized by Jack Smith, a Justice Department special counsel who investigated Trump. The acting attorney general also faced questions about his department's handling of the Epstein investigation. He said he would commit to not recommending a pardon for former Epstein associate Ghislaine Maxwell. Trump approval drops to 35% as Republican support softens, Reuters Ipsos poll finds. By Nathan Land and Nathan Lane. President Trump's presidential approval rating fell to nearly its lowest level since he returned to the White House, hit by a drop in support among Republicans, according to a new Reuters Ipsos poll. The four-day poll, which closed on Monday, showed 35% of the country approved of Trump's job performance, down a percentage point from a Reuters Ipsos poll earlier this month, and just above the low point of his presidency, 34%, seen last month. Trump started his current term in January 2025 with a 47% approval rating. The president's popularity has taken a hit this year as Americans suffer from surging gasoline prices since Trump ordered strikes on Iran in February alongside Israel. The war shut down a large chunk of the global oil trade, sending prices at the pump for Americans about 50% higher, and raising concern among Trump's Republican allies who will be defending their congressional majorities in the November midterm elections. Discontent is spreading within Trump's party, with 21% of Republicans saying they now disapprove of the president's performance, compared to 5% just after he took office in January 2025. Some 79% of Republicans in the poll said Trump was doing a good job, down from 82% earlier in the month, and 91% at the start of his term. Republicans have soured in particular on Trump's handling of the cost of living for Americans, an issue he promised to address during his campaign in 2024, after a bout of high inflation bedeviled his predecessor in office, Democrat Joe Biden. Only 47% of Republicans give Trump a thumbs up on the cost of living, compared to 46% who say he's doing a bad job. Among Americans overall, just 1 in 5 approve of Trump's stewardship over the cost of living. The poll, which was conducted online, gathered responses from 1,271 adults nationwide and had a margin of error of 3 percentage points for Americans overall and 5 percentage points for Republicans. Republican political strategists said the downward turn in Trump's popularity could be a sign of flagging enthusiasm among Republican voters ahead of the November elections, when control of both chambers of the U.S. Congress will be up for grabs. The bigger concern I would have is that Republicans don't seem to be as motivated to turn out in midterm elections as Democrats do right now, said Jeanette Hoffman, a Republican consultant. Hoffman said it remained unclear how much impact Trump's declining numbers might have, with 4 out of 5 Republicans still backing him. 80% is still a pretty big number, she said. Trump's support within his party has held more firmly for his immigration policy, another issue central to his 2024 presidential election campaign, and which has animated core supporters, a group he refers to as the Make America Great Again movement, or MAGA. Some 82% of Republicans approve of Trump's handling of immigration. Little changed from last year. Trump also came to office on promises to avoid what he called forever wars, like the U.S. military interventions in Iraq and Afghanistan, which occupied U.S. troops for most of the last quarter century. He has argued that the conflict with Iran has been a success, touting strikes that killed the country's leader and many senior politicians. A fragile ceasefire has been in place since April, but Iran has largely refused to allow oil tankers to pass through the Strait of Hormuz, which before the war saw a fifth global oil trade. Just 62% of Republicans approve of how Trump is handling the situation in Iran, while 28% disapprove. According to the latest Reuters Ipsos poll, Democrats overwhelmingly disapprove, as do two-thirds of independents. Overall, just 1 in 4 respondents in the poll, and about half of Republicans, said the U.S. military action in Iran has been worth it. Divisions awaiting Warsh to be on display in Fed Minutes release, by Dan Burns. The depth of the differences among Federal Reserve policymakers' views on the direction of interest rates and severity of inflation will be on view on Wednesday with the release of a readout of the most divided meeting in a generation, one that also marked the end of Chair Jerome Powell's leadership tenure. With Powell's successor Kevin Warsh set to be sworn in on Friday, Wednesday's release of the minutes of the April 28th through 29th meeting will add critical detail about shifts in two blocks of Fed officials waiting to greet him, a growing one wary of the inflation arising from the war in Iran and of any talk of future rate cuts, and a diminishing one still leaning towards lowering borrowing costs. Warsh, who says he relishes a good family fight and has himself laid out arguments in favor of lower interest rates, will become Fed chair at a White House ceremony hosted by President Donald Trump, who appointed him, and who has been explicit in his demands for deep rate cuts. The minutes could show just how hard it will be to prevail in an argument for easier policy, though Trump himself has recently downplayed those expectations. The Federal Open Market Committee, the Fed's rate-setting body, left its short-term policy rate unchanged in a range of 3.5% to 3.75% last month, but four policymakers dissented, the most since 1992. Moreover, the dissents were mixed. One official, Governor Stephen Miron, another Trump appointee who will leave the Fed on Friday to vacate a seat for Warsh, dissented in favor, again, of a rate cut. Three others, meanwhile, dissented over the continued use of language in the accompanying policy statement that suggests the Fed still may cut rates. Those three, and others in the weeks since the meeting, point to inflation that is running well above the Fed's 2% target and likely to move further away from it in the near term, thanks to widening price pressures aggravated by the U.S.-Israeli-led war on Iran. The conflict has sent oil prices up by more than 50%, and the latest consumer and wholesale inflation data show price pressures have begun widening beyond the energy sector. They also note a steady jobless rate and 2 months of stronger-than-expected job creation, indicate the employment market remains resilient and is not in need of lower interest rates to prop it up. A key focus in Wednesday's readout will be a section used to describe the FOMC debate about the outlook for monetary policy. The minutes of the March meeting, for instance, showed an increase from the prior meeting in January in the number of policymakers who felt there was a case for a two-sided description of the committee's future interest rate decisions in the post-meeting statement. That indicated that more among them felt a rate hike could be appropriate if inflation were to remain above target. While Wednesday's minutes are somewhat stale in light of the solid April jobs report and last week's elevated inflation readings, they will nonetheless be useful for benchmarking the evolving size of the group advocating for more neutral forward guidance, Deutsche Bank analysts wrote ahead of the release. As a reminder, three officials dissented to the slight easing bias in the forward guidance language of the April FOMC meeting statement. Since that meeting, the Fed speak has moved in a somewhat more hawkish direction. Indeed, after 8 years with Powell at the helm, Warsh will convene his first Fed meeting on June 16th through the 17th with no prospect seen for a change in rates, and certainly not a cut. U.S. and global bond markets, in fact, increasingly reflect a conviction that the Fed and other top central banks will be lifting interest rates before long to lean against war-induced inflation. The yield on the 2-year U.S. Treasury note, a proxy for Fed policy expectations, has shot from just below 3.4% on February 27th, the day before the U.S. and Israel launched airstrikes against Iran, to a 15-month high above 4.1% on Tuesday. Meanwhile, a Reuters poll on Tuesday showed a hefty shift among economists away from previously solid expectations for rate cuts this year, with fewer than 50% now projecting a reduction by December, down from 2/3 just a month earlier. Roughly half see no change in rates this year, and a handful of respondents penciled in at least one rate hike. U.S. Senate advances measure curbing Trump's Iran war powers by Patricia Zengerle. The U.S. Senate advanced a war powers resolution on Tuesday that would end the Iran war unless President Donald Trump obtains Congress's authorization, a rare rebuke of the Republican leader, 80 days after the U.S. and Israeli forces began striking Iran. The vote on a procedural measure to advance the resolution was 50-47, as four of Trump's fellow Republicans voted with every Democrat but one in favor. Three Republicans missed the vote. The result was a victory for lawmakers who have been arguing that Congress, not the president, should have the power to send troops to war, as spelled out in the Constitution. However, it was only a procedural vote, and the resolution faces steep hurdles before going into effect. Even if it eventually passes the 100-member Senate, the resolution must also pass the Republican-led House of Representatives and garner 2/3 majorities in both the House and the Senate to survive an expected Trump veto. Democratic Senator Tim Kaine of Virginia, who sponsored the resolution, said a ceasefire offered Trump an ideal opportunity to make his case to Congress. As the president has said, Tehran has made a new proposal to end the U.S.-Israeli war that began on February 28th. That's the perfect time to have a discussion before we start up war again. The president is receiving peace and diplomatic proposals that he's throwing into the trash can without sharing them with us, Kaine said during debate before the vote. Trump's Republicans blocked seven previous attempts to advance similar resolutions in the Senate this year. They have also stopped three war powers resolutions by narrow votes in the House this year. Multiple votes. Senator John Fetterman of Pennsylvania was the only Democrat to vote against the measure. Republicans Rand Paul of Kentucky, Susan Collins of Maine, and Lisa Murkowski of Alaska voted in favor, as did Senator Bill Cassidy of Louisiana days after he lost his primary to an opponent backed by Trump. The war powers vote was the second in the Senate since the conflict hit a deadline on May 1st, 60 days after Trump formally informed Congress that the conflict had started, for Trump to come to Congress about the war. Under a 1973 U.S. War Powers law passed in response to the Vietnam War, a U.S. president can wage military action for only 60 days before ending it. Asking Congress for authorization or seeking a 30-day extension due to unavoidable military necessity regarding the safety of United States armed forces while withdrawing forces. Trump declared on May 1st that a ceasefire had terminated hostilities against Iran. Despite that assertion, the U.S. has been blockading Iranian ports and striking Iranian ships, and Iran has been effectively blocking the Strait of Hormuz and attacking U.S. ships. Democrats and a few Republicans have called on Trump to come to Congress for authorization to use military force, noting that the U.S. Constitution says that Congress, not the president, can declare war. They have expressed concerns that Trump may have entered the country into a long conflict without setting out a clear strategy. Republicans in the White House say Trump's actions are legal and within his rights as commander-in-chief to protect the U.S. by ordering limited military operations. Some congressional Republicans have accused Democrats of filing the war powers resolutions only because of their partisan opposition to Trump. Wall Street rises on chips strength ahead of NVIDIA results, by Regini Mathur and Utkarsh Hathi. The tech-heavy Nasdaq led gains on Wall Street on Wednesday, lifted by a rebound in chip stocks ahead of NVIDIA's quarterly earnings, which investors view as a crucial test of AI demand. NVIDIA, the world's most valuable company and the centerpiece of the global AI boom, rose 0.7%. The company's results are expected after the closing bell. Investors will crunch the number for signs that appetite for AI infrastructure remains strong enough to support lofty valuations across the technology and AI space. The expectation is that NVIDIA's earnings will be strong. It's the extent to which they are stronger than what is currently baked into markets that will be important, said James McCann, senior economist at Edward Jones. The bar continues to rise for some of these companies. Can it continue to beat that bar? That's going to be a critical aspect for investors. The broader chip sector also advanced on Wednesday. Marvell Technology rose 7.8%, Intel gained 6.3%, and Micron Technology added 3.6%. The Philadelphia SE Semiconductor Index advanced 2.9%. At 9:51 a.m. Eastern Time, the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 32.63 points to 49,396, spot 51. The S&P 500 gained 18.25 points to 7,373, spot 20, and the Nasdaq Composite gained 105.36 points to 25,981, spot 68. 8 of the 11 main S&P 500 sectors were in the green, with the tech sector leading gains with a 0.8% rise. U.S. stocks have come under pressure in recent days as a sell-off in global bond markets drove yields higher. The benchmark 10-year Treasury yield, which touched a 16-month high of 4.687% in the previous session, eased to 4.651% on Wednesday. Traders have ramped up bets the U.S. Federal Reserve could raise interest rates at the turn of the year as the conflict in the Middle East pushes oil prices higher, reviving inflation worries. Brent crude futures slipped 3% to $108.82 a barrel after U.S. President Donald Trump again said the war with Iran would end very quickly. Still, investors remained cautious over the outcome of peace talks as disruptions to Middle Eastern supply continued. Investors are also awaiting the minutes from the Fed's latest meeting, scheduled to be released later in the day, for clues on policymakers' thinking as expectations for a rate hike continue to grow. Markets are now pricing in a more than 40% chance of a 25 basis point rate hike in December, according to CME's FedWatch tool. Expectations for a 50 basis point increase that month have risen to 13.7% from 4.2% a week earlier. Among other movers, Intuit declined 3.5%. Reuters, citing an internal memo, reported that the company is laying off about 3,000 employees. TJX gained 5.4% after the off-price retailer raised its annual comparable sales and profit forecasts, banking on resilient demand at its stores. Target shares fell 7.1% even after the retailer doubled its annual sales growth forecast, while Lowe's declined 3.8% as the home improvement firm reaffirmed its full-year forecast. Games and toy maker Hasbro fell 8.8% after the company reaffirmed its annual forecast. Advancing issues outnumbered decliners by a 1.68-to-1 ratio on the New York Stock Exchange and by a 1.61-to-1 ratio on the NASDAQ. The S&P 500 posted 7 new 52-week highs and 14 new lows, while the NASDAQ composite recorded 32 new highs and 104 new lows. Target doubles growth forecast but cites caution as consumers remain stretched, by Juveria Tabassum and Nicholas Brown. Target raised its annual sales growth forecast for the first time in 2 years, but cautioned a tough macro environment ahead as the retailer tries to turn itself around after an extended sales slump. New CEO Michael Fiddelke, in his first earnings call since taking the top job from Brian Cornell in February, was pleased with the company's 5.6% sales growth this quarter, but said, "We will not confuse this progress with potential." Target shares initially rose before reversing course and were down about 6% in early trading on Wednesday. The $59 billion retailer has muddled through 3 straight years of declining revenue as cost-conscious shoppers move to cheaper options. Its merchandise also failed to attract higher-income consumers looking for nice-to-have apparel and home decor. Target now expects net sales to grow around 4% this fiscal year, double its prior target of 2% growth. Expectations were high, but Target checked every box, said Chuck Grom, analyst at Gordon Haskett Equity Research. Still, Fiddelke cited recent dips in consumer sentiment and said he was not wanting to swing too hard, too quickly. His plan to draw back shoppers included spending an extra $2 billion this year to ensure well-stocked merchandise and cutting prices on 3,000 items in response to the fuel shock. It shows early promise, with same-store sales growth far exceeding expectations of a 2.5% rise, ending 4 quarters of decline, according to data compiled by LSEG. "We laid out a really ambitious plan for this year, and it will be the first of a series of years of ambitious plans, would be my guess," Fiddelke said on Wednesday's earnings call. Target shares have jumped about 30% so far this year. Consumer-facing companies have been conservative about their full-year goals as the Iran war increases costs of fuel and impacts company profits. Q1 results delivered on a high bar, but revised guidance implies a slowdown throughout the remainder of the year, said Stephen Shemesh, analyst at RBC Capital Markets. What's working for Target? Perfect execution was crucial if Target wants to overcome Walmart's price advantage and gain back market share, analysts have said. Target sits in a middle ground of retail, not the cheapest, not the go-to place for any one thing, said Morningstar analyst Brett Huseline. For the 3 months through May 2nd, Target posted a rise in sale in all six of its core merchandising categories, compared with declines in five categories a year ago. Sales grew in the double digits for toys, where the company priced more products south of $10, executives said, while net sales jumped 6% in the food and beverages category, where it added 3,000 new food items. Target also benefited from its newly introduced baby boutique segment, offering more premium brands in about 200 stores, and which comes ahead of its planned Target Beauty Studio launch in nearly 600 stores this fall season. It expects adjusted earnings per share at the upper end of its target range of $7.50 to $8.50. Same-day deliveries drive digital orders. Lower prices and fresher products on the shelves helped Target better compete with the aggressive pricing strategies from Walmart and Amazon, as well as off-price retailers like TJX and Ross stores, while store remodels helped stock inventory better and fulfill online orders. Digital sales surged 8.9%, Target said, well above the 1.9% growth in the prior 3 months, a 27% jump in same-day deliveries under Target's Circle 360 membership program also helped, as households sought convenience and the option to save fuel. Target's first quarter gross margin rate was up slightly at 29%, helped by savings from its supply chain efforts, growth in Roundel advertising revenue, and lower markdowns. Adjusted earnings per share of $1.71 beat estimates of $1.46. Retail bellwether Walmart will report quarterly results on Thursday. Lowe's sticks to forecasts amid muted U.S. housing market, flags cost pressures, by Anuja Bharat Mistry. Lowe's on Wednesday joined larger rival Home Depot in signaling a squeeze from the subdued U.S. housing market and said elevated oil prices were fueling higher transportation and input costs. U.S. consumer sentiment in early May and a popular mortgage rate rose last month as the Iran war pushed up oil prices and treasury yields, piling more pressure on a market already strained by elevated home prices. Company executives on a post-earnings call said the impact of rising costs was building in the current quarter without providing further details. Lowe's estimates about half of the 20% of tariff refunds it received have been used to mitigate the higher fuel costs, CEO Marvin Ellison said on the call. The company's shares were down about 1% in morning trading. Pro demand powers strong quarter. Lowe's, which expects the broader market to remain flat this year, retained its target of fiscal 2026 comparable sales of flat to up to 2% and adjusted profit per share of between $12.25 and $12.75. With housing turnover at historic lows, retailers like Lowe's are losing out on a key source of renovation demand, though maintained guidance signals confidence that pro strength can offset do-it-yourself softness, said Zach Stambor, analyst with eMarketer. A report from the National Association of Realtors earlier this month showed listed houses were staying longer on the market relative to the same period last year. Like Home Depot, Lowe's also beat first quarter sales estimates on steady growth in professional-driven categories, particularly in rough plumbing and electrical wiring. Lowe's has been investing in its pro segment serving small to medium contractors, carpenters, and builders by expanding assortments and offering job site delivery. We're operating in a K-shaped economy where the higher-income consumers are spending on home upgrades, while the lower-income consumers are a bit more cautious and uncertain, Ellison said. Comparable average ticket for the quarter rose 1.5%, while comparable transactions dipped 0.9%. quarterly sales of $23.08 billion beat estimates of $22.97 billion, according to data compiled by LSEG, while adjusted profit of $3.03 per share topped expectations of $2.97. Police officers who guarded Capitol sue to block Trump's $1.8 billion slush fund. By Jan Wolf. Two police officers who defended the U.S. Capitol from rioters on January 6, 2021, filed a lawsuit on Wednesday seeking to halt President Donald Trump's nearly $1.8 billion fund to compensate victims of political weaponization. In a complaint filed in federal court in Washington, former Capitol Police Officer Harry Dunn and Metropolitan Police Department Officer Daniel Hodges alleged that Trump has created a $1.776 billion taxpayer-funded slush fund to finance the insurrectionists and paramilitary groups that commit violence in his name. The lawsuit seeks a court order blocking payments from the fund, calling it the most brazen act of presidential corruption in this century. Trump settled on Monday with the Internal Revenue Service, agreeing to drop his $10 billion lawsuit over the leak of his tax returns during his first term. As part of the settlement, the Justice Department created the fund to compensate victims of political weaponization. U.S. Acting Attorney General Todd Blanche faced repeated questions over that fund during congressional testimony on Tuesday. Blanche said the money could be given to members of any political party and is not limited to January 6 defendants. The standard for who will get money, he said, is broadly defined by those who experienced weaponization. Dunn, a black 15-year veteran of the police force that protects U.S. lawmakers, has been vocal about the physical and racist abuse he endured during the attack as Trump supporters sought to prevent Congress from certifying former President Joe Biden's 2020 victory, including before a bipartisan House of Representatives panel that investigated the deadly riot. He said he has battled post-traumatic stress disorder from the event. During the Capitol attack, Hodges was pinned in a revolving door by a rioter wielding a police shield, a moment that became a viral video. He remains on Washington's police force and has testified before Congress about his experience. Am I out? Drought and rising costs from Iran war deepen the pain for U.S. farmers. By Tom Polensic and Julie Ingerson. From Tulia, Texas, Scott Earlbeck crouched in a field of stunted wheat plants in a parched stretch of West Texas and slipped his hand into a crack wide enough to swallow it. Last autumn, Earlbeck planted a crop that barely grew because rain never came. He now hopes his insurance adjuster will declare it a total loss so he will not need to spend money on pricey fuel to harvest it next month. Soaring costs of fuel and commercial fertilizer in the wake of the Iran war are making hard times worse for farmers across the U.S. plain states of Texas, Kansas, Oklahoma, South Dakota, and Nebraska. Even before the war, farmers were struggling with a resurgent drought, high input costs, and the fallout from President Donald Trump's trade policies, which hobbled export markets and drove down prices for their crops. Since the closure of the Strait of Hormuz in late February, the cost of farm diesel has climbed 72%, the Kentucky Farm Bureau wrote in prepared testimony to U.S. Senate Agricultural Committee hearing this month. Prices for urea, one of the major fertilizers produced in the Gulf region, were up 55%, while prices for another nitrogen-based fertilizer rose 33%, the farmers group said. And yet, because of the drought, farmers are looking at the prospect of smaller harvests to pay for it all. Earlbeck, who did not buy fertilizer supplies in advance for a sorghum crop he will plant this month, said he will probably not use any at all because of soaring prices and the pernicious drought reducing potential yields. "There's fuel, there's drought, there's fertilizer," Earlbeck said, ticking off his challenges. "I've got three strikes. Am I out?" Texas is the third largest wheat-growing state in the country, second for sorghum and first for cotton. Where Earlbeck farms near Tulia, Wind gusted across dry brown fields dotted with dirty clumps of cotton and brittle sorghum stalks left over from previous harvests. U.S. farmers are expected to produce the smallest crop of hard red winter wheat, which is used to make bread, since 1957, according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture. "I'm just waiting for it to die," Earl Beck said. More than 60% of the continental United States, an area with a population of about 153 million people, is experiencing drought, up from 43% at the start of 2026 and 33% a year ago, according to the most recent government U.S. Drought Monitor report. In Oklahoma, it may be too late for rain to help wheat in the hardest hit areas, Amanda D. Oliveira Silva, an Oklahoma State University agronomist, said in late April. "Rain can help preserve what's left, but it won't reverse the damage already done," she said. In South Dakota, farmers were rethinking plans to apply fertilizer to wheat they planted last fall due to high prices and bad growing conditions, said Clarence Winter, South Dakota State University Extension agronomist. When asked for comment on fertilizer costs, the U.S. Department of Agriculture said in a statement to Reuters that the entire Trump administration was focused on ensuring greater domestic production of affordable fertilizer. For farmers like Tommy Salisbury, who grows wheat, sorghum, and soybeans in Tulsa County, Oklahoma, higher prices for inputs wiped out the benefits that flowed to individual operators under the Trump administration's $12 billion aid package meant to offset the fallout from tariffs. "We're paying input prices of 2026, but we're getting crop prices and grain prices of the 70s and 80s, he said. USDA Secretary Brooke Rollins acknowledged farmers were facing hardships. "We are seeing significant price increases at a time when our farm economy is struggling," she told a news conference on Tuesday. However, a survey by the American Farm Bureau Federation, the leading U.S. farm lobby, found that although 80% of U.S. farmers had locked in some supplies last fall, most could not afford the fertilizer they needed for this growing season. Advance buying is more common in the Midwest because many farmers rotate plantings between corn and soybeans and make purchase decisions well ahead of planting. As for comment, the USDA said it was continuing to evaluate the data on fertilizer usage.